So by the end, my therapist was doing something criminal. He doubled down and kept pressing with the pills. So I gave up. I said, I'm never going to get better. You know, life is not worth living. And when I was 23, I attempted suicide 2 days in a row. And the second day, I succeeded in sending myself into overdose. And that was sort of the day that everything started to change for me.
Welcome to the Let Good Things In show. I'm your host, Amanda Acker. I am so happy you are here. At the Let Good Things In show, we talk all about second chances, resiliency, following your intuition, and even music. Listen to hear stories of hope and to be inspired. Remember, you are stronger than you think. Let's dive in. Hi, my amazing humans. Thank you so much for tuning in to today's episode. I'm so grateful for each and every one of you, and I would absolutely love to hear from you. If you're on Instagram, send me a message at the Let Good Things In show, or you can always email me amanda@amandaacker.com, A-C-K-E-R. Today's episode features an amazing human that I'm so grateful to have met through Podcast Evolutions, and now he's also my mentor, which is amazing because he has his own podcast, which is outstanding. And he is just such a wealth of information and such an inspiration. So I'm so grateful that he agreed to be on my show to share his story and answer some questions. His name is Jay Schiffman. Jay Schiffman is a vulnerable storyteller, stigma-destroying speaker, podcaster, and event host. The survivor of 2 suicide attempts and an overdose, Jay holds a BA in psychology from Northern Kentucky University and has put in numerous hours of independent learning, acquiring certifications in mental health, substance misuse, and addiction and drug policy. Jay founded his company, Choose Your Struggle, in 2015 with 2 distinct goals: ending stigma and promoting honest and fact-based education around the topics of mental health, substance misuse and recovery, and drug use and policy. For more information, you can visit jay.campsite.bio, or you can find him on social media. I will have all of his links in the show notes, of course, as always. And without further ado, let's dive in. Hi, Jay. Welcome to the show. So happy to have you here.
Oh, it's always good to chat with you, and it's fun to do so now with the mics rolling. It's funny, you know, most of the time when I'm on a show with somebody, I don't know the host nearly as well as I know you. So this will be a fun one.
Awesome. Yeah, I agree. Usually I've met my guests like once prior to having the interview. So it's different when you have kind of a relationship beforehand. So Jay, you know, I as many of my listeners might know, I've recovered from COVID and I'm kind of not as prepared as usual. So I'm grateful that I know you for that reason as well. So just to start things off, I know a lot of your past, you talk a lot about mental health, recovery, and things like that. So could you just start telling me your story of, you know, what your life was like as a child and how you discovered that you had mental health issues and, you know, kind of lead into like where drugs started to play a part in that? I know that's a loaded question, but.
No, not at all. And for your listeners, you know, I also am unfortunately getting over COVID. I'm about 2 weeks out from when I first started having symptoms. So It's that time. I feel like we're all, half the people in my orbit have either recently got it or have it. It's terrible.
It is.
Yeah. So I am, despite being, or in addition to being two weeks in recovery from COVID, I'm also 12 years in recovery from struggling with addiction, substance misuse, mental health stuff. I mean, the mental health stuff is ongoing, right? I can't say that my sure footing with that is nearly as strong as it is with addiction and substance misuse and just general drug use. But really, my entire story dates back to being a preteen. I was struggling with various issues of mental health my whole life. I've had OCD, you know, that's just one of those things that I've been dealing with, and depression and anxiety, and that's just who I was. But as a preteen, I was also diagnosed with ADHD, and I don't dispute that diagnosis. I want to make that very clear for the listeners what they're about to hear. It was a correct diagnosis. What I dispute is the treatment I got for it. This was in the late 90s. I am 36 years old. And for those who don't know this, this was the time when my generation was being used as really test subject for ADHD treatment. And what that literally looks like is in the late 80s, there were roughly 350,000 young people in this country treated for ADHD or ADD and the whole umbrella of that disorder. By the late 90s, that was 2 million. I know. And you can't hear that and think, well, that's normal. That's standard, right? But that's the reality. And by the way, I once gave that figure on stage and a woman walked up to me afterwards and went, thank God we're not doing that anymore. And I said, lady, that number is now 4.5 million. This has never stopped. It's continued to grow. So unfortunately, though, because this was such a quick explosion, what you get is also a bunch of new medication being rolled out very quickly. And of course, they do research, but really the way that that research is done is by getting it out there and giving it to people. And in about 5 years, I went through 5 or 6 different treatments for ADHD before finally landing on what's called Concerta. And I was on that for the next 6 years. But all of that could have been its own thing. Like, you know, a lot of people, like I said, 2 million people have that story. Unfortunately for me, because I was already struggling with other issues of mental health, my therapist saw this perfect storm that he had helped create. And to lay that out just even more clearly, not only was I being treated for ADHD, not only was I struggling with these other issues of mental health, but remember what is going on in your bodies, in your brain during your preteen and teenage years, right?
Right.
Puberty is not fun for anybody. You were just telling me about your son's girlfriend issues, and you know, when we're that age, that feels like your entire world, right?
Yes.
I mean, you don't have the emotional regulation yet, and so one emotion, especially a strong one like rejection or something like that, that can feel like your entire world is ending.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, my therapist saw this perfect storm. And instead of recognizing the role he played in it with these different treatments for ADHD and really just the reality of a young brain on high levels of medication, he decided to give it a new name. He thought I was showing signs of a different mental health disorder. And he called that a mood disorder, which he then labeled bipolar 2. Now, I didn't have bipolar disorder. And when you start to treat somebody, as I was by the time I was 19, I was being treated for that medically as well. When you start to treat somebody for a disorder like that that they don't have, you're going to see some stuff. There are going to be issues. And that certainly became the case for me.
Wow. So you went from having ADHD to bipolar? How does that?
So what I like to say is that my therapist, I don't think at the time that he was intentionally doing something malicious. I do later. I think he did some really screwed up stuff later. But at the time, I think he was just overzealous. I think he saw a kid who was struggling, and there's no bones about that. I was struggling. But instead of sitting back and saying, let's pick this thing apart, let's figure out what's really going on here, he, you know, was kind of late, you know, he was checking things off and he was doing it well. Okay, I see this, that's ADHD. I see this, that's clearly depression, clearly anxiety, whatever, right? And so he was kind of on a roll. And instead of going, all right, let's pause, he went, let's continue, and I'm going to keep naming things. And he gave me a pretty serious diagnosis of bipolar disorder.
Yeah, that's a very serious diagnosis. I'm not bipolar, but there are people in my family who are. And that's not, you know, the medications that you're given for bipolar are very intense medications. They cause all kinds of side effects. And when you're under the age of 25, from my understanding, these medications can have even worse side effects where you become suicidal. If you're that young, you know, a lot of those medications too can make you gain weight, which will cause insecurity and body image issues. Like, the list goes on and on. Like, did you have any suicide attempts or anything stemming from that?
Yeah, yes. In fact, it's a big part of my story. But you said another really key piece. The weight gain is part of it, for sure. But really, what I like to say is that when you don't have the disorder and you're given these medications, you're not seeing side effects, you're seeing effects. I mean, they were producing things in me that weren't there. And what that looked like for me was an inflammation of the other issues of mental health I was already struggling with. And in some cases, the effects of these medications mirrored things that you would expect somebody struggling with a very severe issue of mental health to be experiencing. And so it became sort of a round robin situation, right? Where it was like, all right, I'm having these symptoms, which then reinforce my therapist's belief that I have this disorder, which means more medication, which produces more symptoms, and it just keeps going. And by the time I was in my early 20s, so let's say 22, I was really not doing well. I had gained a lot of weight. I was an athlete in high school, and I looked completely different. I was like a different human being. My mental health was spiraling out of control. And his answer for all of this always was just more pills. And here's the really interesting piece to me. During this period, by this point, I'm on more than 5 different medications every day. And the only thing making me feel better was cannabis. I smoked a lot of weed. And then that helped me physically. And then mentally, to get out of my life for a while, I was using a lot of psilocybin. I was tripping a lot. And at the time, people were seeing that and telling me that I had a drug problem. But what they meant were those substances, not the pills. And so, of course, now I look back and think how silly all that was, that I, you know, was considered a terrible junkie and all this horrible stuff, not because I was taking 6 different prescribed medications a day, but because I was smoking a lot of weed, but because I was using a lot of shrooms. And then, of course, once that becomes the case, I became the type of guy, I was talking about this with a friend of mine yesterday, where I stopped caring what the drugs were. It was like, you have drugs, give me drugs. And so I got to a point between my 22nd birthday and when I really when my whole life changed right after I turned 23, where I used everything except for heroin and meth. Those were the two I never tried. Everything else at some point I was using. And the only ones I was really addicted to were one of my pills, Klonopin. I was very strongly addicted to, and I had an issue with cocaine there at the end. But for the rest of it, it was like I could pick it up and put it down anytime I wanted. The things that were really a problem were the things that were coming from a doctor, right? My drug dealer was CVS.
That's horrible. Like, and you know, so many people I'm sure have a similar story, and you know, it's really scary. You know, I mean, I've been on psych meds throughout my life, and I mean, I refuse to take them because anytime I would, like, it would, like you said earlier, like, it would make me feel crazy. Like, there's no other word to describe it. Like, you're either numb or you feel manic, or like, you just don't, it's like you feel like you're having this out-of-body experience all the time. And, you know, Klonopin, that was something I was addicted to. I wasn't prescribed it, but I get it. You know, that is something that my experience, like, that was the only thing that made me stop feeling. That was the only thing that took the pain away, you know. And so that was, it's a very addictive drug. And for, you know, nowadays, I know it's a little harder to get benzodiazepines from my experience, but which is good because those are horrible drugs. Like, I've known so many people, especially people on heroin, who would mix heroin and Xanax, which is just another benzo, and die. I mean, that's a horror. They're horrible drugs. Horrible.
Yeah. So a couple of stats to sort of make clear here. Number one, so a lot of these prescriptions, especially the ones that are benzos, they do work for some people. Different studies have shown somewhere between 40 and 60% of people are resistant to mood altering benzos. All medications. And so what that means is for somebody who is struggling with a very severe issue of let's say depression, sure, we should try something like a benzo, probably the case. However, that person should know, unfortunately, I think too many therapists are not forthright with this, that it's probably not going to work, right? I mean, depending on the right study, you're either just over or just under 50% of people. That's a lot of people.
Yeah.
So that can be incredibly demoralizing if you aren't aware of that. And that is exactly what happened with me, where I was on these pills for 4 years. By the end, like I said, I was taking 6 different medications a day, one of which was Klonopin, which is very strong. I was misusing it severely. If anyone remembers the show House, the way he popped his Vicodin, that was me with Klonopin, mm-hmm. but by the handful, multiple times a day. But the problem was I wasn't aware of the failure rate with all these prescriptions, right? And so I trusted my therapist because he was well-known in my city of Cincinnati where I grew up. I believed in these medications. And so I'd been on them for so long and my life had deteriorated to such a point that I finally came to this realization that if I trust my therapist and I trust these drugs, clearly the problem was with me, right? I mean, you can't believe in the other two variables and not see yourself as a failure when your life continues to get worse. And that's why I attempted suicide. I lost all hope because I couldn't, there was not a way for me to understand that my therapist by this point was doing something criminal. And for full disclosure on that, I showed my prescribing records to a friend of mine who's a doctor about 5-6 years ago. And he looked, I didn't tell him it was me. And he looked down at this and he was going over it and going, God, what is this? Right. And he finally looks up at me and goes, Jay, who is this? This is criminal. And I was like, man, those were my records.
Wow.
And he was like, yeah, this is real screwed up. So by the end, my therapist was doing something criminal. And I think what happened was he realized that this had spiraled out of control. But unfortunately for me, if he had admitted that this was bad, that I was clearly addicted to at least one of my medications, that there could have been some negative repercussions for him. And instead of doing, I think, what is the right thing and saying, you know what, this is not going well, let's figure out a different path forward, he doubled down and kept pressing with the pills and that kind of thing. But I couldn't, in my state, I couldn't fathom that. And so I gave up. I said, I'm never going to get better. I clearly, you know, life is not worth living. And when I was 23, I attempted suicide 2 days in a row. And the second day, I succeeded in sending myself into overdose. And that was sort of the day that everything started to change for me.
Wow. You know, when I think about, you know, what you went through and to be that young and I, you know, to feel like, you know, this must be me. Like, why wouldn't you think that, you know, when your therapist is telling you these drugs, you know, help and this is going to make you feel better and then they don't and they seem to be making it worse. Like, I can't, I mean, I could definitely say that I would have felt the same exact way you did. That's horrifying to think, well, maybe I'm just, you know, I'm terminal. Like, there's nothing good for me in this world, so why even try, you know?
And that's exactly how I felt. Thank you for giving words to that, was that I felt that I sort of had what I thought was a moment of clarity where I went, if this is my life, I don't want this. I don't want to keep doing this. And that was what preceded my suicide attempts.
And then so moving forward, you know, you have the suicide attempt and then you overdose. So what happens next?
So I succeeded in sending myself into overdose, but I had done, instead of leaving a suicide note or something like that, both nights I had called a friend of mine to tell her what I was doing. She was sort of my living suicide note. And the first night she sent some friends over who stopped me from taking the lethal pills. That's how I was going to kill myself, with a big pile of pills. And the second night I took the pills first. And so she did what was the right thing to do. She called 911. And unfortunately for me, because this is the US and this was back in 2009, instead of an ambulance or a mental health expert showing up, it was a cop. And I owned a house near the University of Cincinnati, and it had become a trap house. Everybody who lived there, was the only thing we had in common, we were all using a lot of drugs together. So a cop shows up, and of course, what's the last thing anyone there is going to do is help him? No, and no one's going to be like, great, why are you here? Let's figure out this problem. Everyone scatters. And he goes, I'm here for, you know, Jay Schiffman. And like the one person who was sober at the time was like, oh, he's upstairs. So they call me down and I'm in the early stages of overdose. And the cop does what he is trained to do. He puts me in handcuffs and leads me out of the house. And I'm going into full-blown overdose at this point. And the last thing I remember before I blacked out was he threw me into the back seat, but he missed. And my head hits the side of his cop car and I crumple. And that's the last thing I remember. Now, luckily for me, he took me straight to the hospital, I assume, because I spent the night handcuffed to a bed at a hospital. And woke up the next day in sort of a almost a movie-like moment where reality, I have this beautiful picture of reality starting small and like rushing back to me. And I look around and I'm in the intake room of a lockdown unit. And my mother is sitting next to me. I'm in scrubs and I go, where the F am I? I was angry. Not me. I was confused. Right. I was scared. And the last thing I remember was being arrested. And I was sure I was going to die. And here I was in this lockdown unit. And of course, everyone explained to me what had happened. And I spent 3 weeks in this lockdown unit that really wasn't... there was no treatment. It was a holding cell for people that were experiencing mental health issues. You know, movies and TV got this one right. I you know, the whole no shoelaces and drawstring, anything like that. The whole showering with the door cracked open so we can't, you know, hang ourselves or drown. I distinctly remember the shower floor sloped in the middle so that water couldn't pool. So that you couldn't drown yourself. And, you know, there were people that were there because of eating disorders and they had to strip after every meal to make sure they weren't hiding food. I mean, it was a whole thing.
Yes.
So I spent 3 weeks there and then I got released to my parents, who sent me to a long-term care facility, what we would have called a mental institution 50 years ago. In the Berkshires, in the beautiful town of Stockbridge, Massachusetts, which is very famous as the home of Norman Rockwell. And it looks like a Norman Rockwell painting, you know, fall foliage and cute little Main Street. And weirdly, right off of Main Street is a giant facility that is a mental institution. And I spent 3 months there. And there, luckily, I got to know people with both bipolar, some really wonderful, beautiful people struggling with bipolar, and people who were struggling with addiction. And after a while, I went, you know, those people, that doesn't look like what I'm going through. But those people over there, that looks familiar. That I identify with. And it was a really horrible place. If you've seen One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, where they all sit in a circle and just pick somebody apart, that was a regular part of our treatment.
Oh my goodness.
It was horrible. Luckily, from what I'm told, most places don't do that anymore. And this was like one of the last holdouts. But it was it was awful. It was truly traumatic. But after a couple of months, I asked my therapist there to let me get off of my medication. I said, look, I don't think I have bipolar. Can we try getting off medication? And he said no. He said the only way he would let me get off of medication is if I agreed to immediately start back up again. And I said, I don't want to do that. I want to live without medication for a while.
Yeah.
And he said no. So I luckily was there against my will, but I wasn't court ordered. So I was able to check myself out. And that's what I did. I checked myself out and started heading cross country to live with my grandmother and grandfather in a little town outside of Sedona, Arizona called Cornville. And that's where I went through a detox.
Wow. You've been all over trying to find recovery. Wow. You know, that's really sad. Like, so they literally would, I'm sorry, I'm stuck on this, but they would sit you in a circle and you would just, now, who was picking the person apart? Was it the leader or was it like everybody would just like basically talk shit? Like, is that
what it was? That's exactly what it was. So the way this worked was our group sessions. We all had our therapists. We all had, you know, all the things you can think of, woodworking. There was an acting studio. I mean, the ancillary pieces were wonderful. But a big part of our treatment was everybody sat in a giant room together, really pretty day room. You know, we're talking probably 40 or 50 people.
Wow.
And you got to just air your dirty laundry. And that could be anything from, I saw, you know, Nancy drinking today. And, you know, you're not supposed to be drinking when you're here. All the way to, I don't like this person because they treat me like this way. And everybody was given the floor. And there were some people who took advantage of that. And I distinctly remember there's only four rules at this place that you cannot break, and it's no fighting, no drinking, no drugs, and no sex. And I never came close to breaking any of the others, but one day I did get into it with another guy in one of these sessions. He wasn't picking on me. I mostly stayed to the background, but I had friends in there, and one day this guy just decided he was going to tear one of my friends apart. And I lost it. I got in his face. We had to be separated. It was a whole thing. Because it was just so damaging. It was so awful watching people say whatever the hell they want. And the only time that the focus was ever on me was when you want to leave. If you graduate, the center is all behind you. But if you want to leave early, which I did, you have to defend yourself in one of these sessions. Like, the topic of the day is Jay is leaving, right? And what's so scary about those is not only do the patients get to say whatever the hell they want, but the entire medical team come. And so, you know, I didn't care what some of the patients said. Most of the people I knew I was cool with, and the couple who weren't, like, I didn't care. But the head of therapy spent a good couple of minutes telling me how I was throwing my life away, how I was weak, how I was a failure. And that would have broken me. Luckily for me, one of my friends who skipped those, she had been there long enough where she kind of could do whatever she wanted. But she refused to go to those sessions. She was like, I'm not going to do this. But that day she came and just to sit with me and to hold my hand while these people tore me apart. And if it wasn't for her, I wouldn't have gotten through this. I would have been a puddle on the floor. But she sat with me and she gave me the strength to sort of sit there quietly and take it as this, you know, 60-year-old woman with 30 years of experience and a PhD told me that I was a failure and was throwing my life away.
Oh my goodness. An educated woman who, or whatever, who is like, supposed to be a therapist to make people help people move forward in their lives, called you a failure in front of all of your peers. That is one of the most messed up things I've ever heard.
Yeah, wow. So I was on a show a couple years ago with a young woman named Ashley Loeb Blassingame, who runs the Courage to Change podcast for Lion Rock. Really, really great show. And she and I talked about this because she had been through a similar treatment in a different facility out in California. And we sort of compared our experiences, and she said, you know why they do this, right? And I was like, I mean, I have my ideas, but please tell me. She said, the goal of this is to break you down, because if you are broken down, then they can rebuild you in a way that at least to them makes sense, right? It's like, you know, you are this person. It may not be best for you, but it's what our textbooks or our methods or whatever it is that they're going off of says is the right way to do. So in that woman's defense, I don't think she saw what she was doing to me as traumatic or anything. She's wrong. She very clearly is wrong. But she was coming from a place of what her science said was the right thing to do. Now, I don't agree with that. I think it needs to be thrown out. It's junk. But I don't think she was just trying to be a bitch. I think she was trying to do what she thought was the right scientific treatment or whatever.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I can see that, but it's still, like you said, doesn't change the fact that that was extremely wrong. I mean, I'm pretty sure that's what they do to people in military school, right? Where they, we're not in the military. Like, obviously we're here because we're struggling with mental health issues. The last thing we want to do is be sitting in a room getting told we're pieces of shit. Like, that's just not, that's not productive. That can seriously make someone kill themselves. Like, that's horrible.
Well, and it's so sad because you're right. And while I was there, 4 people did take their lives. And, you know, one of whom I knew well. And the thing that finally drove, I wanted out because my therapist wouldn't, you know, allow me to get off the pills. But I'll tell you, the thing, I don't talk about this that much, but the thing that was the final straw, my best friend in there, not the woman who sat and held my hand, a different woman, I stopped her personally. I literally physically stopped her from killing herself because I picked up the signs when nobody else did. And that was the final straw, because this was supposed to be a place that was, you know, going to watch out for us and take care of us. And I already knew that that was bullshit. I mean, I'd seen it, right? But it finally pulled the wool back from my eyes that I was like, if I had not seen these signs, because I care enough about this person, she would be dead. They would have found her body. She would be dead. And I cannot stay in a place where I did a better job than the trained professional. I cannot be here. And this place was so expensive that it was, there was like a name, I don't remember off the top of my head, for people whose families took out mortgages, second mortgages on their homes to send their kids there.
Oh my goodness.
That's how expensive this place is. And yet we're, you know, in the 3 months I was there, 4 people died. And if it wasn't for me, there would have been a 5th. So that was the final straw for me.
I could imagine, you know, like you're in a, like you said it, you know, those people were supposed to be there to keep you safe. And your friend could have been just another statistic, you know, and you shouldn't have had to have been put in a position where you had to save her life. Like, you know, and if they're charging that much money, that's even more ridiculous. Like, are you kidding me? So you go, you move with your parents, you're in detox, you know, after you detox off these pills, like how did that, what did that feel like for you? Be finally being able to be released from that.
So I went through what's called step down detox. For those listeners who don't know, that's the opposite of cold turkey. Cold turkey can literally kill you if it's done poorly. Really important to say that, because, you know, the movies and TV, oh, you got to go cold turkey. Don't go cold turkey unless you're in an intake place or you're with a doctor. It is very dangerous. Step down is the opposite, where you take a little bit less every couple of days. And in my case, because I was on so many medications, what that meant was, you know, it took 3 weeks to get off of this pill and then I switched to the next one. And over time, that took almost 4 months to get off of everything. And the reason that that is so hard is that your body is freaking out, right? You're taking away something that's been it has a built-up tolerance to, in at least one case, if not more, it was literally addicted to. And so I was just in a low level of, like, traumatic pain for almost 4 months. And if it wasn't for my grandmother, who took me in and allowed me just to lay in her guest bed for almost 4 months, you know, I who knows what could have happened, right? But I'm very thankful that she allowed me just to get better in her house. So that took almost 4 months. And at the end of it, you know, we have this belief that once you're off the drugs, it's like, yay, hang the victory banner. You're done, which is not the case whatsoever. It took me a solid 5 years to get healthy after that. You know, remember at this point, I'd been on drugs from, on these prescription pills at least, from 11 to 24, basically.
Wow. That's a long time.
Yeah, most of my life. I'd been on pills for more than I'd been off them as a living, breathing human being. So it took me a solid 5 years for my body, my mind, my maturity, my, like, all of it to catch up and be realigned. And in that time, you know, I was sort of relearning how to live. I had my first adult relationships. I went back to school and got a degree, all that kind of stuff. But in end of 2015, I finally was feeling good for the first time in my life. And a buddy of mine ran a storytelling event in Cincinnati, where I was still living at the time. And he asked me to tell my story on stage. Much shorter version of the story. And I said, you've got to be kidding me. Like, there's no way in hell I'm ever going. That's what stigma is, right? I was sure, because I was still thinking that I had been some kind of failure, you know, that I, that this was my fault or something like that. But he finally persuaded me. And on election night of 2015, I told a version of the story on stage. And it honestly launched, you know, me in this direction. You know, I am now, that was 7 years ago. It was the first time I ever told my story. And not only was it healing, was there healing with that, right? I mean, it was a giant weight off my shoulders. I wasn't hiding anymore. But it also made me into this person now who does this every day and promotes other people's voices. And you know, it all of that is thanks to this one night and this one person giving me a chance. And that's why I do a lot of the stuff that I do now. That's why I have my podcast and that's why I do my storytelling events is to help other people get that opportunity, number one, for healing for themselves. But two, you know, when we all collectively do this, it helps end stigma and promote honest, fact-based education around these topics. I just think that's so important.
Yeah, it is, you know, and I'm grateful that your friend, you know, persuaded you to do that because your voice needs to be heard. And, you know, I think that there's so much stigma around addiction, mental illness, like all the things that incarceration, you know, the things that I talk about. And it's so important that we have people out there using their voice to share their stories, to let people know that you're not alone, number one, because I lived, and I'm sure you did too, for way too long thinking that I needed to hide my truth and, you know, keep it quiet, Amanda. Don't tell anybody. You know, if you tell this person, they're going to judge you. And you're fed that narrative from, you know, the news or the movies or whatever, you know, social media, you know, all these things that make you feel like you're less than. But at the end of the day, my new thing that I say all the time is, like, we're all human first. Like, we go through experiences and some, you know, to your story might be more extreme than this person's and vice versa, but we're still human and we all deserve respect and to have the good things in our lives. You know, we deserve to have a voice. It's so important. And I'm just grateful that you came on the show and said that because I could go on and on.
I agree. I think I no notes, perfectly said.
And Jay, so you mentioned a podcast. So tell us about that and where we could find your podcast.
Well, I do have a weekly called Choose Your Struggle, but the one that I promote the most is I spent almost 10 months doing a documentary serial style series, 10 episodes, on a woman that inspires the hell out of me by the name of Sarah Laurel. And Sarah is like you and me is in recovery from struggles with addiction, her mental health and all that. But Sarah founded the nonprofit Savage Sisters here in Philadelphia that is a recovery housing and a harm reduction outreach organization that I am very lucky to be on the board of. I interviewed Sarah multiple times. I interviewed members of her family, friends, people on the board like myself, volunteers for the organization. And over these 10 episodes, I tell the story of Sarah's life through her struggle with drugs, mental health. She was homeless for many years. She went through so many forms of trauma, sexual assault, physical trauma, all sorts of stuff, and then founded this beautiful organization from the ashes. And I am very proud of that series. It's done incredibly well for itself. It dropped and spent the first 3 weeks of its life on Apple's top 200 list.
Nice.
Disappeared
Congrats.
For a week and then went back for another week. So definitely very proud of that. And more than anything, I mean, the awards, all that stuff's nice, right? But more than anything is the people who've reached out and have been like, holy shit, I was so wrong about drug use, or I was so wrong about what it was like to be homeless and, you know, all this kind of stuff. Those emails are better than any of those rankings, any of the recognition it's gotten, because that's why I do this stuff, right? Is to help people understand. And when you have someone as brilliant as Sarah, and I, you know, think I did a really good job of telling this story, it helps people understand it on a level that they didn't before. This is the best compliment I've gotten. I've had people reach out and say, I want to come to Philadelphia just to meet Sarah and go on an outreach because it's like watching my favorite TV show is what they said, where these people have like ascended to a level of like, wait, these are actual people. These aren't characters. You know what I mean? So I am very proud of this series, and it would mean a lot if people checked it out. But not only that, check it out and then tell me what you think. Tell me if it helped you see drug use in a different light and if you learned something, you know. So you can find that by searching for Choose Your Struggle Presents anywhere on podcasts, anywhere you enjoy this podcast. It's called, the full title is Choose Your Struggle Presents Made It Season 1 Stay Savage. You'll see a logo of a woman with purple hair over a starry sky. That is the series. So check it out. Let me know what you think.
Wonderful. Yes. I've been meaning to check that out. And now that you like described it more, it gave me goosebumps. Like, man, sounds amazing. I want to check that out. So I definitely will. And then if somebody wanted to like reach out to you or find you, where's the best place that someone could get in touch with you?
Yeah, so I have a personal website, jschiffman.com. My business, Choose Your Struggle, also has a website. Both of them have contact me pages. You can find me in all your favorite social medias by either searching for Jay Schiffman or Choose Your Struggle. If you want to have me on your show, please reach out. I'm always happy to talk about these topics, clearly. And really more than anything else, I love hearing from people. I got an email last week from a woman who was like, she didn't know about Choose Your Struggle. She actually found me through Made It, which is the first time this has happened. And she said, I've never heard anyone tell my story so similarly, so beautifully. She said, my story is basically like Sarah's. It just makes me feel good knowing that there are other people who've lived through this and are leading, you know, good lives and that kind of thing. Those are the reasons I do this, those emails, right? So if you're interested, you know, just having a conversation with someone who understands, who's been there, reach out. I would love to hear from you.
Awesome. Well, Jay, I have one last question for you. And that would be the question I ask everyone, except for one person that I forgot to ask it to. And I feel so bad. I said this on my last interview, too. I feel so bad. But what is your number one tip for our listeners to allow the good things into their lives?
That's a beautiful question. I'm so sorry for the person who didn't get to answer it. I think that it's really easy, especially in the world we're living in right now, to look around and go, oh, just honestly, what the hell? You know, like it's every day while we're chatting here. I wouldn't be surprised if something awful is happening around us somewhere. It's just every day now. And it's very easy to get caught up in that. And I want to be really clear. I'm not saying you shouldn't, right? I mean, it's going to take all of us doing our work to get out of this tailspin. So I'm not shaming anybody for that. I'm right there with you. But it is okay to take a break every once in a while and appreciate the good stuff around you. And so what I would say is be intentional about it. I have multiple times throughout my day that it's literally on my calendar to practice mindfulness. I get a buzz on my phone where it's time to do this exercise, right? Those are super important moments because they force you to take a break and actually focus on some positive stuff. And honestly, I would say to anyone listening to this show, you know, props to you because you're doing something not only to support, you know, two independent creators like us, but you're doing something for yourself, right? You're doing something where you are, whether consciously or unconsciously, feeling connected in a way that we don't get to all the time. And so keep doing stuff like this. Keep doing things for yourself, even if they're little things like just putting on a podcast, getting up and going for a walk. You know, be intentional about it. That's my advice.
That's great advice. Thank you so much, Jay. And thank you for taking the time to be on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Anything for you. Happy to do it.
And as a reminder to everyone listening, remember, you're stronger than you think, and you can have the life you imagine, regardless of your past. Make sure to hit that follow or subscribe button so you don't miss an episode of the show, and I will talk to you all soon.